itself. There are no limitations to its potentials. You can adopt artificial limitations through your own ignorance, however. You can identify, for example, with your outer ego alone and cut yourself off from abilities that are a part of you. You can deny, but you cannot change the facts. The personality is multidimensional, even though many people hide their heads, figuratively speaking, in the sand of three-dimensional existence and pretend there is nothing more. In this book, I hope to pull some heads out of the sand. You may break or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take the break. 10:59 to 11:10.
Now, we will shortly be finished with our chapter one, with very little more to go. That is not for the book. I do not mean to underestimate the outer ego. You have simply overestimated it, nor has its true nature been recognized. We will have more to say concerning this point, but for now it is enough to realize that your sense of identity and continuity is not dependent upon the ego. Now, at times I will be using the term camouflage, referring to the physical world to which the outer ego relates, for physical form is one of the camouflages that reality adopts. The camouflage is real, and yet there is a much greater reality within it, the vitality that gave it form. Your physical senses then allow you to perceive this camouflage, for they are attuned to it in a highly specialized manner. But to sense the reality within the form requires a different sort of attention and more delicate manipulations than the physical senses provide. The ego is a jealous god, and it wants its interests served. It does not want to admit the reality of any dimensions except those within which it feels comfortable and can understand. It was meant to be an aid, but it has been allowed to become a tyrant. Even so, it is much more resilient and eager to learn than is generally supposed. It is not natively as rigid as it seems. Its curiosity can be of great value. If you have a limited conception of the nature of reality, then your ego will do its best to keep you in the small, enclosed area of your accepted reality. If, on the other hand, your intuitions and creative instincts are allowed freedom, then they communicate some knowledge of greater dimensions to this most physically oriented portion of your personality.
11:35 p.m. The session was interrupted because Rooney, one of our two cats, wanted to go out for the night. Seth had been doing well. Jane left trance quickly. After I let the cat out, she waited briefly, then decided to call it an evening before Seth could return. It doesn't seem that Chapter 1 is quite finished. Session 513, February 5th, 1970, 9:10 p.m., Thursday. Ordinarily, this session would have been held yesterday, but Jane wanted to try it on a Thursday for variety. Before the session, she said, "I still get stage fright when I think of Seth doing this book on his own." And when the session began, Seth did at once resume work on his book.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, we will continue. The fact of this book is proof that the ego does not have the whole kettle of personality to itself. For there is no doubt that it is being produced by some other personality than that of the writer known as Jane Roberts. Since that Jane Roberts has no abilities that are not inherent in the species as a whole, then at the very least it must be admitted that human personality has many more attributes than those usually ascribed to it. I hope to explain what these abilities are, and point out the ways that each individual can use to release these potentials. Personality is a gestalt of ever-changing perception. It is the part of the identity which perceives. I do not force my perceptions upon the woman through whom I speak, nor is her consciousness blotted out during our communications. Instead, there is an expansion of her consciousness and a projection of energy that is directed away from three-dimensional reality. This concentration away from the physical system may make it appear as if her consciousness is blotted out. Instead, more is added to it. Now, from my own field of reality, I focus my attention toward the woman, but the words that she speaks, these words upon the pages, are not initially verbal at all. In the first place, language, as you know it, is a slow affair, letter by letter, strung out to make a word and words to make a sentence, the result of a linear thought pattern. Language, as you know it, is partially and grammatically the end product of your physical time sequences. You can only focus upon so many things at one time, and your language structure is not given to the communication of intricate, simultaneous experience. I am aware of a different kind of experience, not linear, and can focus upon and react to an infinite variety of simultaneous events. Rupert could not express them, and so they must be leveled out into linear expression if they are to be communicated. This ability to perceive and react to unlimited simultaneous events is a basic characteristic of each whole self or entity. Therefore, I do not claim it as some feat that is exclusively my own.
Seth said with humor,
"Each reader, being presently ensconced within a physical form, I presume, knows only a small portion of himself, as I mentioned earlier. The entity is the overall identity of which his personality is one manifestation, an independent and eternally valid portion. In these communications, therefore, Rupert's consciousness expands, and yet focuses in a different dimension, a dimension between his reality and mine, a field relatively free of distraction. Here I impress certain concepts upon him with his permission and assent. They are not neutral, in that all knowledge or information bears the stamp of the personality who holds it or passes it on. Rupert makes his verbal knowledge available for our use, and quite automatically the two of us together cause the various words that will be spoken. Distractions can occur, as any information can be distorted. We are used to working together now, however, and the distortions are very few. Some of my energy is also projected through Rupert, and his energy and mine both activate his physical form during our sessions, and now as I speak these sentences. There are many other ramifications that I will discuss later. You may take your break.
9:46 to 9:55.
I am not, therefore, a product of Rupert's subconscious any more than he is a product of my subconscious mind. Nor am I a secondary personality, cleverly trying to undermine a precarious ego. I have seen to it, in fact, that all portions of Rupert's personality are benefited and their integrity maintained and honored. There is within his personality a rather unique facility that makes our communications possible. I will try to put this as simply as possible. There is within his psyche what amounts to a transparent dimensional warp that serves almost like an open window through which other realities can be perceived. A multidimensional opening that has to some extent escaped being clouded over by the shade of physical focus. The physical senses usually blind you to these open channels, for they perceive reality only in their own image. To some extent, then, I enter your reality through a psychological warp in your space and time. In a manner of speaking, such an open channel serves much as a pathway between Rupert's personality and my own, so that communication is possible between. Such psychological and psychic warps between dimensions of existence are not infrequent. They are merely recognized as such infrequently and utilized even less so.
Long pause, one of many. But overall, Jane's pace was faster and more confident than in the first two sessions dealing with Seth's book. She also liked what Seth had done on his book so far.
I will try to give you some idea of my own non-physical existence. Let it serve to remind you that your own basic identity is as non-physical as my own. That is the end of chapter one.
Okay. Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 2. My present environment, work, and activities.
It was 10:16. Jane paused, rubbing her closed eyes.
We will begin Chapter 2. While my environment differs in rather important respects from that of my readers, I can assure you, with ironic understatement, that it is as vivid, varied, and vital as physical existence. It is more pleasurable, though my ideas of pleasure have changed some since I was a physical being, being more rewarding and offering far greater opportunities for creative achievement. My present existence is the most challenging one that I have known, and I have known many, both physical and non-physical. There is not just one dimension in which non-physical consciousness resides, any more than there is only one country on your planet, or planet within your solar system. My environment now is not the one in which you will find yourself immediately after death. I cannot help speaking humorously, but you must die many times before you enter this particular plane of existence. Birth is much more of a shock than death. Sometimes when you die, you do not realize it. But birth almost always implies a sharp and sudden recognition. So there is no need to fear death. And I, who have died more times than I care to tell, write this book to tell you so. My work in this environment provides far more challenge than any of you know, and it also necessitates the manipulation of creative materials that are nearly beyond your present comprehension. I will say more of this shortly. First of all, you must understand that no objective reality exists but that which is created by consciousness. Consciousness always creates form, and not the other way around. So my environment is a reality of existence created by myself and others like me, and it represents the manifestation of our development. We do not use permanent structures. There is not a city or a town, for example, in which I dwell. I do not mean to imply that we are off in empty space. For one thing, we do not think of space as you do, and we form whatever particular images we want to surround us. They are created by our mental patterns, as your own physical reality is created in perfect replica of your inner desires and thoughts. You think that objects exist independently of you, not realizing that they are instead the manifestations of your own psychological and psychic selves. We realize that we form our own reality, and therefore we do so with considerable joy and creative abandon. In my environment, you would be highly disoriented, for it would seem to you as if it lacked coherency. We are aware of the inner laws that govern all materializations, however. I can have it night or day, in your terms, as I prefer, or any period, say, of your history. These changing forms would in no way bother my associates, for they would take them as immediate clues as to my mood, feelings, and ideas.
While delivering this paragraph, Jane walked into the kitchen, still in trance, to rummage for a book of matches. She wanted to light a cigarette.
Permanency and stability basically have nothing to do with form, but with the integration of pleasure, purpose, accomplishment, and identity. I travel to many other levels of existence in order to fulfill my duties, which are primarily those of a teacher and educator, and I use whatever aids and techniques serve me best within those systems. In other words, I may teach the same lesson in many different ways, according to the abilities and assumptions that are inherent in any given system in which I must operate. I use one portion of myself from many personalities that are available to my identity in these communications and in this book. In other systems of reality, this particular Seth personality that I, the larger Seth identity, adopt here, would not be understood. All systems of reality are not physically oriented, you see, and some are entirely unacquainted with physical form. Nor is sex, as you understand it, natural to them. Therefore, I would not communicate as a male personality who has lived many existences, though this is a legitimate and valid portion of my identity. Are your fingers tired?
No, I'm okay. 10:54.
Now, in my home environment, I assume whatever shape I please, and it may vary, and does, with the nature of my thoughts. You, however, form your own physical image at an unconscious level in more or less the same manner, but with some important differences. You usually do not realize that your physical body is created by you at each moment as a direct result of your inner conception of what you are, or that it changes in important chemical and electromagnetic ways with the ever-moving pace of your own thought. Having long ago recognized the dependence of form upon consciousness, we have simply been able to change our forms entirely, so that they more faithfully follow each nuance of our inner experience. You may take a break or end the session as you prefer.
We'll take the break. 11 o'clock. Jane's trance had been good, although she appeared to come out of it quickly enough. She said she knew each word as she delivered it during the session, but forgot it almost at once. By 11:05, though, she realized she hadn't really completely come out of it at break after all. Resume at 11:07.
Now, this ability to change form is an inherent characteristic of any consciousness. Only the degree of proficiency and actualization varies. You can see this in your own system, in a slowed-down version when you observe the changing forms taken by living matter through its evolutionary history. Now, we can also take several forms at one time, so to speak, but you can also do this although you do not generally realize it. Your physical form can lie sleeping and inert upon the bed while your consciousness travels in a dream form to places quite distant. Simultaneously, you may create a thought form of yourself, identical in every respect, and this may appear in the room of a friend quite without your conscious awareness. So consciousness is not limited as to the forms it can create at any given time. Practically speaking, we are rather more advanced along these lines than you, and when we create such forms, we do so with complete awareness. I share my field of existence with others who have more or less the same challenges to meet, the same overall pattern of development. Some I have known and others I have not. We communicate telepathically, but then again, telepathy is the basis for your languages, without which their symbolism would be meaningless. Because we do communicate in this manner, this does not necessarily mean that we use mental words, for we do not. We communicate instead through what I can only call thermal and electromagnetic images that are capable of supporting much more meaning in one sequence. The intensity of the communication is dependent upon the emotional intensity behind it, although the phrase emotional intensity may be misleading. We do feel an equivalent of what you call emotions, though these are not the love or hate or anger that you know. Your feelings, can best be described as the three-dimensional materializations of far greater psychological events and experiences that are related to the inner senses. I will explain these inner senses to you later at the end of this chapter. Suffice it here to say that we have strong emotional experience, although it differs in a large measure from your own. It is far less limited and far more expansive in that we are also aware and responsive to the emotional climate as a whole. We are much freer to feel and experience because we are not so afraid of being swept away by feeling. Our identities do not feel threatened, for example, by the strong emotions of another. We are able to travel through emotions in a way that is not now natural to you, and to translate them into other facets of creativity than those with which you are familiar. We do not feel the need to conceal emotions, for we know it is basically impossible and undesirable. Within your system, they can appear troublesome because you have not yet learned how to use them. We are only now learning their full potential and the powers of creativity with which they are connected. We will end our session.
Okay.
My heartiest regards to you both, and a fond good evening.
Good evening, Seth. It's been very good. Still as Seth, Jane leaned forward.
You are the first to read it.
Yes, it's a pleasure. 11:37 p.m. Jane had been really out, she said later. She knew only that Seth had talked about emotion. Session 514, February 9th, 1970, 9:35 p.m., Monday. This session was witnessed by Carl and Sue Watkins and their infant son, Sean. Carl and Sue are members of Jane's ESP class.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Good evening to our friends. You have come to see an author at work, and so we shall continue, if you will bear with us, with Chapter 2. Now, since we realize that our identity is not dependent upon form, therefore, of course, we do not fear changing it, knowing that we can adopt any form we desire. We do not know death in your terms. Our existence takes us into many other environments, and we blend into these. We follow what rules of form exist within these environments. All of us here are teachers, and therefore adapt our methods also, so that they will make sense to personalities with varying ideas of reality. Consciousness is not dependent upon form, as I have said, and yet it always seeks to create form. We do not exist in any time framework as you know it. Minutes, hours, or years have lost both their meaning and their fascination. We are quite aware of the time situations within other systems, however, and we must take them into account in our communications. Otherwise, what we say would not be understood. There are no real barriers to separate the systems of which I speak. The only separation is brought about by the varying abilities of personalities to perceive and manipulate. You exist in the midst of many other systems of reality, for example, but you do not perceive them. And even when some event intrudes from these systems into your own three-dimensional existence, you are not able to interpret it, for it is distorted by the very fact of entry. I told you that we do not experience your time sequence. We travel through various intensities. Our work, development, and experience all takes place within what I term the moment point. Here, within the moment point, the smallest thought is brought to fruition, the slightest possibility explored, the probabilities thoroughly examined, the least or the most forceful feeling entertained. It is difficult to explain this clearly, and yet the moment point is the framework within which we have our psychological experience. Within it, simultaneous actions follow freely through associative patterns, For example, pretend that I think of you, Joseph. In so doing, I immediately experience and fully your past, present, and future in your terms, and all of those strong or determining emotions and motivations that have ruled you. I can travel through those experiences with you if I choose. We can follow a consciousness through all of its forms, for example, and in your terms, within the flicker of an eye. Now, it takes study, development, and experience before an identity can learn to hold its own stability in the face of such constant stimuli. And many of us have gotten lost, even forgetting who we were until we once more awakened to ourselves. Much of this is quite automatic to us now. In the infinite varieties of consciousness, we are still aware of a small percentage of the entire banks of personalities that exist. For our vacations, we visit amid quite simple life forms and blend with them. To this extent, we indulge in relaxation and sleep, for we can spend a century as a tree or as an uncomplicated life form in another reality. We delight our consciousness with the enjoyment of simple existence. We may create, you see, the forest in which we grow. Usually, however, we are highly active, our full energies focused in our work and in new challenges. We can form from ourselves, from our own psychological entireties, other personalities whenever we wish. These, however, must then develop according to their own merit, using the creative abilities inherent in them. They are free to go their own way. We do not do this lightly, however. Now you may take your first break, and we shall continue.
10:02. Jane's trance had been a deep one. She said she'd been exhausted before the session. We had spent the afternoon moving furniture. Nothing seemed to bother Seth this evening once he started, however. Not even Sean nursing. Resume at the same fast pace at 10:20.
Now, each reader is a portion of his or her own entity and is developing toward the same kind of existence that I know. In childhood and in the dream state, each personality is aware to some extent of the true freedom that belongs to its own inner consciousness. These abilities of which I speak, therefore, are inherent characteristics of consciousness as a whole and of each personality. My environment, as I told you, changes constantly, but then so does your own. You rationalize away quite legitimate intuitive perception at such times. For example, if a room suddenly appears small and cramped to you, you take it for granted that this change of dimension is imaginative, and that the room has not changed, regardless of your feelings. The fact is that the room under such conditions will have changed, quite definitely, and in very major respects, even though the physical dimensions will still measure the same. The entire psychological impact of the room will have altered. Its effect will be felt by others beside yourself. It will attract certain kinds of events rather than others, and it will alter your own psychological structure and hormonal output. You will react to the altered state of the room even in quite physical ways, though its width or length, in inches or feet, may not seem to vary. I told our good friend Joseph to underline the word seem, because your instruments would show no physical alteration, since the instruments within such a room would themselves have already altered to the same degree. You are constantly changing the form, the shape, the contour, and the meaning of your physical body and most intimate environment, although you do your best to ignore these constant alterations. On the other hand, we allow them full rein, knowing that we are motivated by an inner stability that can well afford spontaneity and creation, and realizing that spiritual and psychological identity are dependent upon creative change. Our environment, therefore, is composed of exquisite imbalances where change is allowed full play. Your own time structure misleads you into your ideas of the relative permanency of physical matter, and you close your eyes to the constant alterations within it. Your physical senses confine you, as best they can, to the perception of a highly formalized reality. Only through the use of the intuitions, and in sleep and dream states as a rule, can you perceive the joyfully changing nature of your own and any consciousness. One of my duties is to enlighten you on such matters. We must use concepts that are at least fairly familiar to you. In doing so, we therefore use portions of our own personalities with whom you can, to some extent, relate. There is no end to our environment. In your terms, there would be no lack of space or time in which to operate. Now, this would put tremendous pressure on any consciousness without proper background and development. We do not have one simple, cozy universe in which to hide. We are still alert to other quite alien systems of reality that flash on the very outskirts of consciousness as we know it. There are far more various kinds of consciousness than there are physical forms, each with its own patterns of perception, dwelling within its own camouflage system. Yet all of these have inner knowledge of the reality that exists within all camouflage, and that composes any reality, by whatever name it is called. You may now take your break.
10:44 to 10:56.
Now, many of these freedoms are quite natural to you in the dream state, and you form dream environments often to exercise such potentials. Later, I will have at least some remarks to make concerning the ways that you can learn to recognize your own feats, to compare them with your proficiency in daily physical life. You can learn to change your physical environment, therefore, by learning to change and manipulate your dream environment. You can also suggest specific dreams in which a desired change is seen, and under certain conditions these will then appear in your physical reality. Now often you do this without realizing it. Whole consciousness adopts various forms. It need not always be within a form. All forms are not physical ones. Some personalities, therefore, have never been physical. They have evolved along different lines, and their psychological structures would be alien to your own. To some extent, I also travel through such environments. Consciousness must show itself, however. It cannot unbe. It is not physical. It must therefore show its activation in other ways. In some systems, for example, it forms highly integrated mathematical and musical patterns that are themselves stimuli for other universal systems. I am not very well acquainted with these, however, and cannot speak of them with any great familiarity. If my environment is not a permanently structured one, then, as I have told you, neither is your own. If I am aware of communicating now through Rupert, in different ways each of you telepathically communicates to and through other personalities, though with little knowledge of your accomplishment. Now I will end our session. I would sing a lullaby. This is not for the book, for our small friend here.
Sean Watkins, who was nursing again.
But I am not in voice for it. My heartiest wishes to you all, a fond good evening. And this is, indeed, a first and final draft.
Good night, Seth. Thank you, it's been very interesting. 11:08 p.m. Seth's parting remark was in answer to a question Sue had raised earlier in the evening about how much revision his book would require. Jane's opinion so far was that the book wouldn't need any work except for the rearranging of an occasional awkward phrase, etc. Session 515, February 11th, 1970, 9:20 p.m., Wednesday.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
We will return to our chapter 2. Now, the senses that you use in a very real manner create the environment that you perceive. Your physical senses necessitate the perception of a three-dimensional reality. Consciousness is equipped with inner perceptors, however. These are inherent within all consciousness, regardless of its development. These perceptors operate quite independently from those that might be assumed when a given consciousness adopts a specialized form, such as a physical body, in order to operate in a particular system. Each reader, therefore, has inner senses and to some extent uses them constantly, though he is not aware of doing so at an egotistical level. Now, we use the inner senses quite freely and consciously. If you were to do so, then you would perceive the same kind of environment in which I have my existence. You would see an uncamouflaged situation in which events and forms were free and not stuck in a jelly-like mold of time. You could see, for example, your present living room not only as a conglomeration of permanent appearing furniture, but switch your focus and see the immense constant dance of molecules and other particles that compose the various objects. You could see a phosphorescent-like glow, the aura of electromagnetic structures that compose the molecules themselves. You could, if you wished, condense your consciousness until it was small enough to travel through a single molecule, and from the molecule's own world look out and survey the universe of the room and the gigantic galaxy of interrelated, ever-moving star-like shapes. Now, all of these possibilities represent a legitimate reality. Yours is no more legitimate than any other, but it is the only one that you perceive. Using the inner senses, we become conscious creators, co-creators. But you are unconscious co-creators, whether you know it or not. If our environment seems unstructured to you, it is only because you do not understand the true nature of order, which has nothing to do with permanent form, but only appears to have form from your perspective. There is no 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 9 o'clock in the evening in my environment. By this I mean that I am not restricted to a time sequence. There is nothing preventing me from experiencing such sequences if I choose. We experience time, or what you would call its equivalent nature, in terms of intensities of experience, a psychological time with its own peaks and valleys. This is somewhat similar to your own emotional feelings when time seems speeded up or slowed down, but it is vastly different in important ways. Our psychological time could be compared in terms of environment to the walls of a room, but in our case, the walls would be constantly changing in color, size, height, depth, and width. Our psychological structures are different, practically speaking, in that we consciously utilize a multidimensional psychological reality that you inherently possess, but are unfamiliar with at an egotistical level. It is natural, then, that our environment would have multidimensional qualities that the physical senses would never perceive. Now, I project a portion of my reality as I dictate this book to an undifferentiated level between systems that is relatively clear of camouflage. It is an inactive area, comparatively speaking. If you were thinking in terms of physical reality, then this area could be likened to one immediately above the atmosphere of your Earth. However, I am speaking of psychological and psychic atmospheres, and this area is sufficiently distant from Rupert's physically oriented self so that the communications can be relatively understood. It is also, in a way, distant from my own environment. For in my own environment, I would have some difficulties in relating information in physically oriented terms. You must understand that by distance, I do not refer to space. You may take your break.
9:56. Jane's trance has been good, but she was out of it almost at once. Resume at 10:22.
Creation and perception are far more intimately connected than any of your scientists realize. It is quite true that your physical senses create the reality that they perceive. A tree is something far different to a microbe, a bird, an insect, and a man who stands beneath it. I am not saying that the tree only appears to be different. It is different. You perceive its reality through one set of highly specialized senses. This does not mean that its reality exists in that form in any more basic way than it exists in the form perceived by the microbe, insect, or bird. You cannot perceive the quite valid reality of that tree in any context but your own. This applies to anything within the physical system that you know. It is not that physical reality is false. It is that the physical picture is simply one of an infinite number of ways of perceiving the various guises through which consciousness expresses itself. The physical senses force you to translate experience into physical perceptions. The inner senses open your range of perception, allow you to interpret experience in a far freer manner, and to create new forms and new channels through which you, or any consciousness, can know itself. Consciousness is, among other things, a spontaneous exercise in creativity. You are learning now, in a three-dimensional context, the ways in which your emotional and psychic existence can create varieties of physical form. You manipulate within the psychic environment, and these manipulations are then automatically impressed upon the physical mold. Now, our environment is, in itself, creative in a different manner than yours. Your environment is creative in that trees bear fruit, that there is a self-sustaining principle, that the earth feeds its own, for example. The naturally creative aspects are the materializations of the deepest psychic, spiritual, and physical inclinations of the species, set up in your terms eons ago, and a part of the racial bank of psychic knowledge. We endow the elements of our environment with an even greater creativity that is difficult to explain. We do not have flowers that grow, for example, but the intensity, the condensed psychic strength of our psychological natures forms new dimensions of activity. If you paint a picture within three-dimensional existence, then the painting must be on a flat surface, merely hinting at the complete three-dimensional experience that you cannot insert into it. In our environment, however, we could actually create whatever dimensional effects we desired. All of these abilities are not ours alone. They are your heritage. As you will see later in this book, you exercise your own inner senses and multidimensional abilities more frequently than it might seem in other states of consciousness than the normal waking one. Since my own environment does not have easily defined physical elements, you will be able to understand its nature by inference as I explain some related topics throughout this book. Your own physical environment appears as it does to you because of your own psychological structure. If you gained your sense of personal continuity through associative processes primarily, rather than as a result of the familiarity of self moving through time, then you would experience physical reality in an entirely different fashion. Objects from past and present could be perceived at once, their presence justified through associative connections. Say that your father, throughout his lifetime, has 8 favorite chairs. If your perceptive mechanisms were primarily set up as a result of intuitive association rather than time sequence, then you would perceive all of these chairs at one time. Or, seeing one, you would be aware of the others. So environment is not a separate thing in itself, but the result of perceptive patterns, and these are determined by psychological structure. So if you want to know what my environment is like, you will have to understand what I am. In order to explain, I shall have to speak about the nature of consciousness in general. In doing so, I shall end up telling you much about yourself. The inner portions of your identity are already aware of much that I will tell you. Part of my purpose is to acquaint your egotistical self with knowledge that is already known to a larger portion of your own consciousness that you have long ignored. You look out into the physical universe and interpret reality according to the information received from your outer senses. I will stand, figuratively speaking, in physical reality and look inward for you, and describe those realities of consciousness and experience that you are presently too fascinated to see. For you are fascinated with physical reality, and you are in as deep a trance now as the woman is through whom I write this book. All of your attention is focused in a highly specialized way upon one shining bright point that you call reality. There are other realities all about you, but you ignore their existence and you blot out all stimuli that come from them. There is a reason for such a trance, as you will discover, but little by little you must wake up. My purpose is to open your inner eyes. And I end our session. We are close to the end of chapter 2. Now I wish you a good evening.
Good night, Seth. It's been very good. 11:12 p.m. Jane was quickly out of a deep trance. I don't remember anything. Session 518, March 18, 1970, 9:25 p.m., Wednesday. Jane has been taking something of a rest for the last month or so. She's had but 2 regular sessions, one for friends and a personal one for us, and only one for her weekly ESP class. Class sessions aren't numbered. Occasionally, Jane has wondered what effect, if any, the break would have on Seth's book. However, after giving me some very astute data about my painting, Seth resumed book dictation very smoothly at 9:33, just as though there hadn't been any time lapse from February 11th to March 18th. A note. I thought it would be of interest to show, by periodically recording the time, how long Seth takes to deliver a certain amount of finished material for his book.
Give us a moment, then. I will give you the very last of chapter 2 and begin the following chapter. My environment includes, of course, those other personalities with whom I come in contact. Communication, perception, and environment can hardly be separated. Therefore, the kind of communication that is carried on by myself and my associates is extremely important in any discussion of our environment. In the following chapter, I hope to give you an idea, quite simply, of our existence, the work in which we are involved, the dimension in which we exist, the purposes that we hold dear, and most of all, of those concerns that make up our experience.
Seth Speaks by Jane Roberts. Copyrighted material. All rights reserved.
Chapter 3. My work and those dimensions of reality into which it takes me.
9:43.
Now I have friends even as you do, though my friends may be of longer standing. You must understand that we experience our own reality in quite a different manner than you do. We are aware of what you would call our past selves, those personalities we have adopted in various other existences. Because we use telepathy, we can hide little from each other, even if we wished to. This, I am sure, seems an invasion of privacy to you, and yet I assure you that even now, none of your thoughts are hidden, but are known quite clearly to your family and friends, and, I may add, unfortunately, to those you consider enemies as well. You are simply not aware of this fact. This does not mean that each of us is like an open book to the other. Quite the contrary. There is such a thing as mental etiquette, mental manners. We are much more aware of our own thoughts than you are. We realize our freedom to choose our thoughts, and we choose them with some discrimination and finesse.
Pause at 9:49.
The power of our thoughts has been made clear to us through trial and error in other existences. We have discovered that no one can escape the vast creativity of the mental image or of emotion. This does not mean that we are not spontaneous or that we must deliberate between one thought or another in anxious concern that one might be negative or destructive. That, in your terms, is behind us. Our psychological structure does mean that we can communicate in far more various forms than those with which you are familiar, however. Pretend, for example, that you meet a childhood friend whom you have long forgotten. Now, you may have little in common, yet you may have a fine afternoon's discussion centered about old teachers and classmates and establish a certain rapport. So, when I meet another, I may be able to relate to him much better on the basis of a particular past life experience, even though in my now, we have little in common. We may have known each other, for example, as entirely different people in the 14th century, and we may communicate very nicely by discussing those experiences, much as you and your hypothetical childhood friend established rapport by remembering your past. We will be quite aware that we are ourselves, however, the multidimensional personalities who shared a more or less common environment at one level of our existence. As you will see, this analogy is a rather simple one that will do only for now because past, present, and future do not really exist in those terms. Our experience, however, does not include the time divisions with which you are familiar. We have far more friends and associates than you do, simply because we are aware of varying connections in what we call for now past incarnations.
10 o'clock.
We have, of course, therefore, more knowledge at our fingertips, so to speak. There is no period of time in your terms that you can mention, but some of us have been from there and carry within our memories the indelible experience that was gained in that particular context. We do not feel the need to hide our emotions or thoughts from others because all of us by now well recognize the cooperative nature of all consciousness and reality and our part in it. We are highly motivated. Could spirits be anything else?
I guess not.
Simply because we have at our command the full use of our energy, it is not diverted into conflicts. We do not fritter it away, but utilize it for those unique and individual purposes that are a basic part of our psychological experience. Now, each whole self or multidimensional personality has its own purposes, missions, and creative endeavors that are initial and basic parts of itself, and that determine those qualities that make it eternally valid and eternally seeking. We are, finally, free to utilize our energy in those directions. We face many challenges of quite momentous nature, and we realize that our purposes are not only important in themselves, but for the surprising offshoots that develop in our efforts to pursue them. In working for our purposes, We realize we are blazing trails that can also be used by others. We also suspect, certainly I do, that the purposes themselves will have surprising results, astounding consequences that we have never realized, and that they will merely lead to new avenues. Realizing this helps us keep a sense of humor.
10:11.
When one has been born and has died many times, expecting extinction with each death, and when this experience is followed by the realization that existence still continues, then a sense of the divine comedy enters in. We are beginning to learn the creative joy of play. I believe, for example, that all creativity and consciousness is born in the quality of play, as opposed to work, in the quickened intuitional spontaneity that I see as a constant through all my own existences and in the experience of those I know. I communicate with your dimension, for example, not by willing myself to your level of reality, but by imagining myself there. All of my deaths would have been adventures had I realized what I know now. On the one hand, you take life too seriously, and on the other, you do not take playful existence seriously enough. We enjoy a sense of play that is highly spontaneous, and yet I suppose you would call it responsible play. Certainly it is creative play. We play, for example, with the mobility of our consciousness, seeing how far one can send it. We are constantly surprised at the products of our own consciousness, of the dimensions of reality through which we can hopscotch. It might seem that we use our consciousness idly in such play, and yet again, the pathways we make continue to exist and can be used by others. We leave messages to any who come by, mental signposts. I suggest your break.
10:25. Jane was out of her trance easily. She had delivered the material smoothly and without long pauses in an average voice. She was quite surprised to learn that an hour had passed, however. Jane had no images or visions, as far as she recalled, when dictating material. Resume at a slower pace at 10:35.
We can be highly motivated, therefore, and yet use and understand the creative use of play, both as a method of attaining our goals and purposes, and as a surprising and creative endeavor in itself. Now, in my work as a teacher, I travel into many dimensions of existence, even as a traveling professor might give lectures in various states or countries. Here, however, the resemblance ends largely, since before I can begin to work, I must set up preliminary psychological structures and learn to know my pupils before teaching can even begin.
Jane's delivery was quite a bit slower now.
I must have a thorough knowledge of the particular system of reality in which my pupil operates, of his or her system of thought, of the symbols that are meaningful. The stability of the pupil's personality must be correctly gauged by me. The needs of that personality cannot be ignored, but must be taken into consideration. The pupil must be encouraged, but not overly extended while development continues. My material must be presented in such a way that it makes sense in the context in which the pupil understands reality, particularly in the early stages. Great care must be utilized, even before serious learning can begin, that all levels of the personality develop at a more or less constant rate. Often the material I present will initially be given without any sign of my presence, seemingly as a startling revelation. For no matter how carefully I present the material, it is still bound to change past ideas that are strongly a part of the pupil's personality. What I say is one thing, but the pupil, of course, is thrust into psychological and psychic behavior and experience that may seem quite alien to him on a conscious level.
pause at 10:51.
The problems vary according to the system in which my pupil has his or her existence. In your system, for example, and in connection with the woman through whom I now write this book, initial contact on my part was made long before our sessions began. The personality was never consciously aware of the initial meeting. She simply experienced sudden new thoughts, and since she is a poet, these appeared as poetic inspirations. At one time, some years ago, at a writer's conference, she became involved in circumstances that could have led to her psychic development before she was ready. The psychological climate at that time of those involved initiated the conditions, and without realizing what she was about, our friend Jane went into a trance.
Long pause at 11:01. In 1957, after Jane had sold her first few short stories, she was invited to a conference of science fiction writers at Milford, Pennsylvania. I couldn't go because of my own work, so Jane attended the conference with Cyril Kornbluth, now deceased, a friend and a well-known writer who lived near our home in Sayre, Pennsylvania. Jane went into a trance one evening during a discussion. Out of this episode, which we did not understand was a trance for several years afterward, evolved a group of writers, Jane among them, who called themselves the Five. Long and involved letters were exchanged among the members of the Five by a round-robin technique. The four other writers in the group were much better known than Jane was.
I had known of her psychic gifts since her childhood, but the insights necessary were channeled through the poetry until the personality attained the necessary background that was needed in this particular case. In the affair just mentioned, therefore, I was informed and saw to it that the episode ended and was not pursued. It was hardly an accidental performance, however. Quite without knowing it, the personality decided to try its wings, figuratively speaking. As a part of my work, therefore, I have been coaching the young woman in one way or another since her childhood, and all of this as a preliminary to the serious work that began with our sessions. This is a normal part of my activity in many levels of existence. It is highly diversified work, for the personality structures vary. While within the systems in which I work there are certain basic similarities, in some dimensions, I would not be equipped to be a teacher simply because the basic concepts of experience would be alien to my nature, and the learning processes themselves outside of my own experience. You may take your break.
11:09. Jane's trance had been good. I haven't the slightest idea what that was all about. Her pace had picked up a bit. Resume at 11:20.
Now, we will continue our book at our next session.
Seth dictated a few paragraphs of material for a woman who had recently lost her husband. She had requested a session.
And now I bid you good evening.
Good night, Seth.
My heartiest regards, and if you did not have to take notes, I would talk with you longer.
Thank you. End at 11:30 p.m. Session 519, March 23, 1970, 9:10 p.m., Monday.
Good evening.
Good evening, Seth.
Now, your ideas of space are highly erroneous. So in my contacts with your sphere of activity, I do not sweep through bright golden skies like some spiritual Superman into your physical domain. I will go into this in a later chapter. But in a very real manner, space, as you perceive it, simply does not exist. Not only is the illusion of space caused by your own physical perceptive mechanisms, but it is also caused by mental patterns that you have accepted, patterns that are adopted by consciousness when it reaches a certain stage of evolution within your system.
9:16. As in last session, I will indicate the time periodically to show the rate at which Seth delivers material.
When you arrive or emerge into physical life, not only is your mind not a blank slate, waiting for the scrolls that experience will write upon it, but you are already equipped with a memory bank far surpassing that of any computer. You face your first day upon the planet with skills and abilities already built in, though they may or may not be used, and they are not merely the result of heredity, as you think of it. You may think of your soul or entity, though only briefly and for the sake of this analogy, as some conscious and living, divinely inspired computer who programs its own existences and lifetimes. But this computer is so highly endowed with creativity that each of the various personalities it programs spring into consciousness and song, and in turn create realities that may have been undreamed of by the computer itself.
925.
Each such personality, however, comes with a built-in idea of the reality in which it will operate, and its mental equipment is highly tailored to meet very specialized environments. It has full freedom, but it must operate within the context of existence to which it has been programmed. Within the personality, however, in the most secret recesses, is the condensed knowledge that resides in the computer as a whole. I must emphasize that I am not saying that the soul or entity is a computer, but only asking you to look at the matter in this light in order to make several points clear. Each personality has within it the ability not only to gain a new type of existence in the environment, in your case, in physical reality, but to add creatively to the very quality of its own consciousness, and in doing so, to work its way through the specialized system, breaking the barriers of reality as it knows it.
930.
Now there is a purpose in all this that will also be discussed later. I mention this whole subject here, however, because I want you to see that your environment is not real in the terms that you imagine it to be. When you are born, then, you are already conditioned to perceive reality in a particular manner and to interpret experience in a very limited but intense range. I must explain this before I can clearly give you an idea of my environment or of those other systems of reality in which I operate. There is no space between my environment and yours, for example, no physical boundaries that separate us. In a very real way of speaking, your concept of reality as seen through your physical senses, scientific instruments, or arrived at through deduction, bears little resemblance to the facts, and the facts are difficult to explain.
934. Seth Jane leaned forward for emphasis, gesturing, eyes dark and wide.
Your planetary systems exist at once simultaneously, both in time and in space. The universe that you seem to perceive, either visually or through instruments, appears to be composed of galaxies, stars, and planets at various distances from you. Basically, however, this is an illusion. Your senses and your very existence as physical creatures program you to perceive the universe in such a way. The universe, as you know it, is your interpretation of events as they intrude upon your three-dimensional reality. The events are mental. This does not mean that you cannot travel to other planets, for example, within that physical universe, any more than it means that you cannot use tables to hold books, glasses, and oranges.
As our coffee table did at that moment.
Although the table has no solid qualities of its own. When I enter your system, I move through a series of mental and psychic events. You would interpret these events as space and time, and so often I must use the terms, for I must use your language rather than my own. Root assumptions are those built-in ideas of reality of which I spoke, those agreements upon which you base your ideas of existence. Space and time, for example, are root assumptions. Each system of reality has its own set of such agreements. When I communicate within your system, I must use and understand the root assumptions upon which it is based. As a teacher, it is part of my job to understand and use these, and I have had existences in many such systems as a part of